Session number 17551, Reel 2.
Mr. Wilson, Reel 2. You just showed me a photograph of one of these Altmark-type tankers, an aerial photograph, and you said that this is from a book called Coastal Command.
It's a well-known book, yes.
And you tell me that you took this photograph. Aerial photography one of your duties then?
Well, sometimes, yes. We had a camera pointing straight down. When we flew over anything in daylight and looked interesting, we just pressed a button and it took photographs.
Do you remember taking the photograph?
Oh, yes, I remember taking it, all right. And we dropped a bomb on that. Actually, if you look carefully, you can see it in that photograph.
Is this the bomb on the back, on the stern of the ship?
Yeah. I don't think we had any effect.
How much flak could such a ship put up in its own defence?
Quite a lot, actually. I don't know, quantify it exactly, but certainly looked formidable.
Before you were shot down, was your Beaufort ever hit?
No, it wasn't actually. No, we were very lucky. The most exciting part of my rather short career in operations was the hunting of the Bismarck when it was out, because we were the nearest land-based station to where it probably would be. And the whole of St. Devil's operations room filled up with top brass, both Air Force and Navy. And they had the big plot of the Bear Biscay and the southwestern approaches. And you saw exactly what was happening all the time, the blow minute by minute thing, you know, with Force H coming up from Gibraltar and various ships coming out of Plymouth. And then when the Catalina found her on about May the 24th, I think it was, we all worked out exactly where she was and said, she's out of our range. Which was, I don't know whether we were pleased or sorry, but I think on the whole we were pleased. We followed it blow by blow then. We saw exactly, you know, when they crippled her with the torpedo bombers, when she was going around in circles, and then when she was finally sunk, you couldn't tear yourself away from the operations room, because it was absolutely sort of history in the making and drama and everything else, you know. And of course we were all ready to go. I mean, the planes were ready and everything, you know. And other squadrons had come in from other parts of the country. And also a Fleet Air Arm squadron was based in St. Neville for a time. So it was really quite, it felt as though you were at the centre of things for once.
So you didn't get airborne yourself?
No, we didn't. Oh, we did. We went out on what they call a curve of search, where you start off with an assumption of where the ship might have been at some point. Then you went out on a curve, twice visibility from the previous one. So you were gradually spiralling out until you couldn't spiral any further because you're running out of fuel. And about six of us did that, all starting at different points. And we didn't find her, of course, because she was just, as I say, outside our range. It was the Catalina who found her.
Any other incidents that happened to you during your operations, apart from the shooting down, which we'll come to soon?
No, those are the sort of things we did, you see. I mean, I can't sort of say how many. Because my logbook disappeared. I don't know whether it's in anybody's archive anywhere. But, of course, I didn't have it with me when I was shot down. We're not likely to, really. And it would have been in my locker. So presumably the Air Force authorities looked after it or destroyed it or whatever.
Did you ever spot any U-boats as you were patrolling?
No. We looked for them, but we never spotted them. They're quite difficult to find, you know, unless they're absolutely on the surface.
Now, can we come on to how you were shot down, and can you take me through the incident step by step in detail, please?
Well, we set off, I suppose, about 12 noon on August 11th, 1941, three of us. The idea was we were looking for enemy shipping, particularly tankers, and we went right across the Breton Peninsula. And by a pre-arranged plan, when we got to somewhere near Lorient, the other two went off in different directions to further south. And we found, we went towards Lorient, and we found this tanker, which may have been the same one I'd photographed a few weeks earlier, though I don't no means of knowing whether it was. But it was roughly the same sort of tanker. And we went round once, and the pilot wasn't... We did sort of shallow dive bombing, which is not a very accurate way of bombing, but anyway, that's what we did. And we dropped a bomb onto it, and its flak caught us in the starboard engine, which packed in completely. So we turned round and made best we could for home. But after we'd gone about 5 minutes, the other engine packed in. In fact, a Beaufort could barely keep up on one engine anyway, but I think we must have been gradually losing height, and we didn't have very much height to begin with, only about something under 1,000 feet. So we ditched somewhere, I suppose about 15 miles from Lorient. And when you ditch, there's a certain routine. I'm alongside the pilot, and the minute we actually get on the water, I pull a thing which opens the hatch, a little handle which opens the hatch above us, so it opens like the, it parts. So we got sort of free air above us. The air gunner stands by the rear hatch, and as soon as it ditches, he is supposed to lean forward and pull the ripcord which releases the dinghy out of the wing. Now the wireless operator, who I knew from later, was actually transmitting our position back home, in the vague hope the air-sea rescue might get us. We were really too far away and too near German-controlled ports to really be feasible. Anyway, he was. And I think he must have left it just a few minutes too late, or too few moments too late, and was somehow trapped in the plane. Anyway, he went down with the plane, because things happen so quickly that you can't really remember, or you can't know exactly what was happening. Anyway, the three of us found ourselves in the water, and the dinghy was there. The other two got in it first. Then they hauled me in, and we were there for about, I suppose, about an hour. And all of a sudden, this looks like a huge ship. It wasn't very big, really. It was a German minesweeper, which I think had been a French trawler, came alongside us and hauled us on board, and then they proceeded to take off our wet uniforms and dry them out a bit. They wrapped us in blankets and fed us with hot soup, which I thought was very civil of the Kriegsmarine. Then we were brought ashore, not actually at Lorient, but at Saint Louis, which is on the opposite bank of the river, and there we were stayed overnight, and then we moved to Paris, where we also stayed overnight.
What was the attitude of the people who rescued you?
Well, the Kriegsmarine were very good, really. I mean, I think the operational troops on either side had a sort of fellow feeling for other operational troops. And the Kriegsmarine treated us very well, and so did the Luftwaffe people we met initially. And then from Paris we went to Gulagluft, which is near Frankfurt on Main. We weren't there very long, and then...
What happened to you at Gulagluft?
Well, not very much as it happened. Whether they thought they knew all they wanted to about us, I don't know, but they only questioned me for in a perfunctory sort of way for a few minutes. And they said, "You're from 217 Squadron, aren't you?" And I said, "Am I?" sort of thing, you know. And, you know, they... And then we were in the general camp. I think their idea was that the camp was, I think, bugged. I'm certain it was. So they were really as much interested in recording what we were saying to each other. And you're more likely to, if you think you're not being overheard, or even if you do, people tend to give away things. So I think they probably learned far more by just listening to the gossip in the camp. But we're there about a week or 10 days, I suppose. Then Austin and I were moved to a little camp called Stalag 3E, and Rance, being an officer, moved to Stalag Luft 3. Then 3E was a... It had been a youth hostel, I think.
Was it Stalag Luft 3E?
No, it wasn't. It was Stalag 3E. It was an army camp run by the army. I think we moved there as a sort of temporary measure, because waiting for the new compound at Stalag Luft 3 to be completed, which is an NCO's compound. And we moved there to the other camp, to Stalag Luft 3, in about 1942. It was, as I say, it was August 41 when we were shot down. And round about October, we had a visit from the protecting power, which was still the United States. So they must have been one of the last diplomatic things they did as a protecting power before they came in the war.
This was to Stalag Luft 3?
This was to Stalag 3E. As I say, it was run by the army, the Reichswehr. It moved to Stalag Luft 3 in...
Did the protecting power do anything for you?
I think they organised a small supply of books for us, which we hadn't got any to begin with. It introduced me to the vagaries of the book trade, actually. They sent us about 100 copies of Goodbye, Mr. Chips, instead of 100 different titles. And also Shangri-La, I think, another one. But, that was an absurdity, you know. There's some paperback house, American pocketbooks, sent out these things in stacks of 100 copies of the same title, which was palpably absurd if you want a library. Anyway, we did. And Stalag Luft 3, of course, was very much bigger. And we got, consequently, we had more facilities in the way of sort of like a theatre room and things like that, and a certain amount of space where we could knock balls around, various kinds. And we had a very good camp leader who was the most remarkable man, in fact, one of the most remarkable men I've ever met, who we called Dixie Dean. He died a few years ago now. But he spoke German, and of course his German improved as long as we were there, and he knew exactly how far to take the Germans and how much you could get away with and where to draw the line and everything. I think he was really an extraordinary man.
Why was he so extraordinary?
Force of personality is all you can call it, I think. I know the International Red Cross people at Geneva said he was the most remarkable NCO they'd ever come across in any other forces. He could impress his personality on people. And you, in a sense, how to do something that would please the Germans without giving anything away to us. There's a complicated parade, what do they call it, not tradition, but procedure, where you're handing over a troop of men to another officer, to a higher officer. It's full of sort of salutes and counter-marching, goodness knows what. And Dixie learnt all this and decided to do it one day. And this sort of German inspecting general thought it the most amazing thing he'd ever seen in his life, because didn't think anybody except the German Luftwaffe or German forces could do things like this, you see. And Dixie carried it off with great aplomb, you see, with tongue in his cheek all the time, you see. But it didn't do any harm, but it did a certain amount of good. And that was the kind of thing he could do, because he thought, this isn't quite a bad idea to do this, you see, just a sort of... Anyway, we began to organise a education system in Stalag-Duff 3, rather so-called barbed wire university, which was a kind of high-flown sort of term which people cooked up. A chap called Eddie Alderton. Eddie Alderton was one of the moving spirits in it. I think if you can find his address, it might be worthwhile recording his memoirs. He was living in Bexhill, I think. But we took exams in all sorts of subjects, organised by the through the International Red Cross and the British Red Cross. Most of the professional bodies, such as the Institute of Actuaries, the various accountants, the solicitors, the Law Society, and also London External degrees. So it became quite a big thing. I mean, lots of us were very occupied in this sort of thing. You could do various things if you're a prisoner of war. You get involved in the theatre, which was quite good. I mean, after all, we produced Roy Dotrys. You could get involved in escaping, of course, which people always think is the main thing, which of course it is to some extent, but you're either an escaping type or you're not. I don't think I ever was, really. And the escaping thing, of course, had other ramifications, in the sense that we had people who were skilled at making maps and printing and forgery. I still think one chap, whose name I won't mention, but I always think when I see case of somebody forging £50 notes or something, that his name might crop up, because he was quite extraordinary. He could look at a German pass, an Ausweis, sort of, and he'd just look at it for a while, and he'd do a perfect facsimile of it in Indian ink, and you couldn't tell the difference in the end. I'm rather kind of joining two bits together here, because although all these things happened in Stalagmite 3, they happened even more so in Stalagmite 6, which we moved to after about a year in Stalagmite 3. And Stalagmite 6 was a place called Heiterkrug, Crow Hunter, in East Prussia, but really it was almost in Lithuania, in the bit they used to call Memelland. So we were the furthest east of all the camps. And I think the education system reached its sort of highest point then. And we had quite a good library there. There was a library in Berlin called the St. George's Library. It's obviously flourished in the Victorian era and had come to life slightly again in the interwar period. And a lot of their books were shipped out to us at Stalagmite 6. They say that Dixie, our camp leader, one of the things he was skilled at was playing off one German section against another, because the Nazi state was run by a system of mutual suspicion. So, although we had a commandant, the actual guards, the posterns for the camp, were supplied by the local garrison, so we had two lots of people. Camp security was in the hands of Abwehr, you know, Admiral Canaris's outfit, so whose headquarters were in Berlin, which was being bombed, and so on. So if you were skilled at it, and Dixie certainly was skilled at it, you could play one against the other. Say, well, shouldn't this be referred to the commandant of the local garrison? Shouldn't this go, isn't this an Abwehr problem? And so on, you see. So you could tie them up in knots. Because if you quote the rule book to that type of German, they were all jawohling, and yes, of course we must. So that was really a rather entertaining sort of side of things.
How close to Dixie Deans did you get?
I knew him tolerably well. I knew him even better just after the war, because he was up at Oxford for a time. And I saw quite a bit of him then and really got to know him much better. I was on the peripheral of his circle, really. I wasn't really in his inner circle of people who were helping him, like chap we had as his adjutant, a man called Ronnie Moggs, who was a Fleet Street journalist. Cyril Ainslie was another one who was a Fleet Street journalist, worked for the Daily Express. And Peter Thomas was also prisoner of war with us, who later became MP for Conway Valley and later for MP for one of the home counties constituencies. And then he married the Honourable Tessa Deans, the daughter of Basil Dean, later on. And ultimately, having been secretary for Welsh Affairs for a short time, then chairman of the Conservative Party also for a fairly short time, and then became Lord somebody or other, name of which I can never remember, but I think he was too much involved in Heath's government to get any further than he did. But he might be worth interviewing. You can probably find him quite easily. We were, what year are we? Could you pass me that wartime log? Good. In July 1943, we moved to Stalagmite 6, which, as I say, was in Heiterkrug in Memelland on the borders of Lithuania. And there we were until the until 1944. Before we moved, you could hear the sound of the guns on the Eastern Front. First, it was just a kind of low murmur. And you thought, can you hear anything or not? And then it gradually got louder and louder, until trying to estimate how far away they were, you see, and whether we would actually be overrun by the Russians. And in fact, they moved us, I suppose, almost at the last minute. First of all, to Thorn, it's spelt in English, I think Tolln is the nearer pronunciation in Poland, to a very large camp, which is an army camp called Stalag 357. We were there only for a few weeks, 6 weeks perhaps, not much more. Then we moved west to a place called Fallingbostel, which was also designated as Stalag 357. Nobody ever quite fathomed completely the journey.